of this, our second day of sitting in the month of March. And we have with us this morning students from Monticello High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class. This program is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. Students from all over the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they accept this invitation, they're sent the briefs of the case we are about to hear, and they may do some extra work on this case. And then as part of the program, they meet with a justice at noon to discuss the procedures the court uses in taking and deciding cases. They do not discuss the substantive matter of the cases before us. Anyone in the courtroom is invited to join the students at the noon session, and they will be joined by students from Edgar High School who are coming for the next case. Let me tell you that this is a national award-winning program, and we are very proud of it. Thousands of students have joined us for this program. If anyone would like a summary of this case, please raise your hand, and the marshal has summaries available for you. Okay, good. Let me introduce the court to you all. Seated on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. Justice Wilcox is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. Seated next to Justice Wilcox is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those preliminary remarks concluded, we'll call our first case, which is 04AP1793, Shane T. Drinkwater versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company, arguing on behalf of Medical Associates Health Plans, Stephen C. Crump. Is it Crump or Crumpy? Crump. Mr. Crump, you may proceed.
May it please the court, let me first say I am sorry to be the cause of anybody's homework. this case involves a choice of law issue. As I was driving down, I was thinking about just my own personal situation in the context of conflict of laws. I'm a second-generation German immigrant from Maryland. My wife is a second-generation Swedish immigrant from Minnesota. We live in Platteville. I drive to work in Iowa every day, just like Mr. Drinkwater. I'm covered by an Iowa health plan. My wife is a professor of history at UW-Platteville. And is covered by a Wisconsin health plan, which turns out is also issued by Medical Associates Health Plans. When I leave this hearing, I'm going to visit with a graduate student at UW-Madison who is a native of Moldova, which is a former republic of the former Soviet Union, who has lived in Iowa, Missouri, and Wisconsin in her 4 years in the United States. I point all of this out simply to show that it's a very multi-state, very mobile, very overlapping world that we live in. And across that overlapping, mobile world we live in are drawn state boundaries. And it is far more common, and in fact it will probably become ubiquitous with the population densities increasing as they are in the border areas of many states, that conflict of issues questions will become one of the dominant legal problems of the next 20 to 30 years. I would say that conflicts of law certainly is not a simple topic. When I was reviewing one of my law school horn books, just getting ready for this, I noticed that the one of the earliest commentators was an Italian judge of the 12th century named Accursius. And I didn't know if Accursius was the name his parents gave him or generations of law students afterwards. I sometimes think conflicts questions remind me of the little rings you used to get out of bubblegum machines 40 years ago, and maybe you still do, where you turn it this way and you saw Superman, and you turned it this way and it was an American flag, and what you saw depended on which way you tilted the ring. Conflicts issues are like that because by definition you always have two contending states. There's always going to be two different sets of state law involved, and there's going to be different rules involved. And the whole process of conflicts of law is trying to adjust those differences in a way that fits within the unique federal system that exists in the United States. I think two of your beautiful murals in this room have applications to this case. The mural behind you is the signing of the United States Constitution. Article 4, Section 1 of the Constitution requires each state to give full faith and credit to the laws of its sister states. That is the canvas on which state conflicts law is drawn. States have discretion to draw their conflicts laws on that canvas, but cannot go outside the canvas without violating the U.S. Constitution.
Counsel, let me interrupt you, if I might, at that point. One of the cases that I found interesting was a case called Nevada versus Hall, which is a case involving the states of Nevada and California. And there, the United States Supreme Court said that a state is not required by full faith and credit to allow a violation of another state's legitimate public policy. It seems to me that case is very important in this situation. Can you tell me why you think it's not?
I think that it is not because it is a given in the state system that once you get outside your borders, by definition, you are intruding into the law of a sister state. And in this case, we have an Iowa employer, an Iowa health plan, a place of employment in Iowa, and an Iowa law that provides for first dollar subrogation. It is our contention that applying Wisconsin law in this case violates the integrity of Iowa law by, in effect, reaching into Dubuque, Iowa, and saying, we don't care what your contracts or your courts say. If the plaintiff lives here, we're going to apply our rules.
Counsel, did I understand you to say that your wife worked for UW-Platteville and has the same plan?
No, it's a different health plan that's set up for Wisconsin employers.
Same company?
It is Medical Associates Health Plan is kind of a parent entity, and it has separate corporations with separate plans in Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin.
I assume that plan doesn't say Iowa law applies.
No, it does not.
Does it say Wisconsin law applies?
It says Wisconsin law applies, and it specifically has language that implements the Rhines ruling, frankly, because the regulators require that language in it, and it's in there.
Let me ask this. There is no made whole doctrine in Iowa because of what, the Ludwig case, is it?
Yes.
Has that case been revisited?
Not that I have found, Your Honor. I did shepherdize it, and it's an area that
isn't that 20 years ago?
Yes. About as old as Rhymes.
Okay. So in the states surrounding Iowa, you have Minnesota that has the made whole doctrine.
Yes.
And Wisconsin and Nebraska. And I don't think we know what the law is in Missouri. So you're relying on South Dakota and Illinois.
I'm relying on Iowa law, and I believe that Illinois law is basically the same as Iowa's, and certainly in terms of border populations, that's the biggest impact.
Law fair?
Yes. I mean, the Iowa courts have held that it is fair. There's nothing unfair about holding an insured to the terms of a written policy. The health plan is not a tortfeasor in the case. There are no equities that weigh against the health plan as they do against the tortfeasor. It affects premiums. It affects the cost of health coverage, particularly in the context of group health plans. And it is a paramount policy in group plans, and it's also the holding of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the Schloss case that in group benefit plans that are employment-related, consistency of benefits and limitations is the overriding consideration. In that case also held that the law governing the master contract, which applies to everybody who participates in the plan, should be the governing law that applies to the plan and to all participants in the plan.
Does Iowa have a statute that says where a victim gets proceeds from another source, that those proceeds should be attributed or deducted from recovery? I mean, that's a statutory subrogation kind of clause.
Yes, there's a procedure in Chapter 668, which is the Comparative Fault Act, that provides for jury form. The jury has to make specific findings on the amount of a subrogated claim. It also has to make a lot of other allocations. This was done to avoid a lot of post-verdict arguments over how much of the verdict should be allocated
to medical expenses, so then they know how to
do
the subrogation.
Yes.
And how to, because the ordinary rule is the tortfeasor doesn't get advantage, right, of collateral proceeds.
That is correct.
Okay. But this is not with the tortfeasor. This is with the insurance plan. Now, how much were his total damages?
The court found that, I don't remember the exact amount, but it was something in excess of $400,000.
Right, but his recovery was?
$250,000, which was the limits under the tortfeasor's policy.
Okay, and if you should prevail, then how much is the insured going to net?
Our subrogation interest is approximately $90,000. Iowa law requires that a pro rata portion of the plaintiff's attorney's fees and costs of litigation be contributed to the plaintiff's counsel. For his efforts in the case, presumably that's something around $33,000, and then the $66,000 would be the, or $60,000 would be about the decrease in the net recovery of the plaintiff.
So the way it would set up, if you prevailed, it would go back, obviously, on the issue of allocating attorney fees and costs. But if you prevail, then victim would recover $190,000, and the insurance company would, in effect, get $60,000. Is that how it works out?
Roughly, that's it. If you ignore the fees that they've paid to me, which I'm sure they'd like to, but
yeah, right. I'm sure you're not. And he recovers $190,000, but would they have to pay attorney fees out of that too?
No.
No, that would be...
They pay a pro rata share of the subrogated portion of the recovery as an attorney fee to the plaintiff's counsel.
So he nets $190,000. His damages were over $400,000.
Yes, but, you know, I guess, again, I...
Those damages include medical costs?
Do the damages include medical costs?
Over $400,000.
I'm sure from the plaintiff's standpoint, they do. I mean, there was no allocation in the stipulation of dismissal. I would bring it back, though, to this is a contract case. Our claim is based only on the contract between the health plan and the employer and the employee who's covered under that health plan. The health plan effectively is a victim of the tortfeasor as well. It has paid expenses only because of the tortfeasor's actions.
But the public policy here is in terms of Wisconsin wanting to see that a victim of negligence, and this is a victim of negligence, recovers in full before there's contractual subrogation, right?
That's correct. And we have never made any contention otherwise. We concede that if Wisconsin law applies, we lose this argument.
So the question is, does this Wisconsin public policy of defending people injured here? And I don't know that any of the cases in the Rhine series affects an outside resident. But so you could even say a Wisconsin victim. Because Wisconsin, if this victim isn't made whole, the possibility of a victim then looking to state funding of one sort or other is high or may be possible. So this is one, a humane version. That is a humane public policy, but it's also a fisc public policy.
There are financial consequences in both states.
Mm-hmm.
The health plan, the consequences of this court's ruling on the health plan will fall in Iowa one way or the other.
Right, and it might increase premiums is what you're saying.
Might increase premiums, might increase costs to employers. It might result in lower benefits to employees. There are potential dollar consequences on both sides of the river, and I think those interests are, from a public policy standpoint, they balance each other, and the overriding interest should be consistency of benefits for people who work at one place covered by one plan. Mr. Drinkwater should not derive a substantial advantage over people who drive two blocks because he drives a couple of miles across the river.
Does it make any difference that this is a tort case rather than a contract case? Basically, we're talking about, and I was looking at the Ruckel case, which is out of this court not so long ago, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, where there was a similar contractual arrangement and this court upheld the made whole doctrine. How do you get around that?
It's not that I get around it. I think the way to look at it is there is a fork in the road. And if the fork goes into Iowa, you never get to Ruckel or any of the other Wisconsin cases. And again, we concede that if Wisconsin law applies, we lose the argument.
Mr. Crump. Let me just back up a moment. You talked about this as being a contract case, but you referred to the tortfeasor as part of your argument. We just heard Justice Wilcox's question about the tort analysis and how this case is should be looked at. Now, as I understand it, we're dealing with a tort. This all arises out of a tort action. You refer to the tortfeasor. It arises out of an accident that occurs in Wisconsin, between Wisconsin residents, and we're talking about the contract after the fact. And aren't we what we're really talking about here is a mixture of the tort claim and the contract. It's not just a contract action, is it?
Perhaps the better terminology would be to say that our claim is only a contract claim. But for our contract, we'd have no claim in this case. The contract involves the proceeds of a tort action.
And recognizing that the contract involves the proceeds of a tort action, analytically, don't we have to finish the tort action first?
Well, the tort action was finished first. I mean, it was a case of liability. Everybody understood that we were just going to save this claim and bring it later. So.
All right. So if you acknowledge that the tort action was finished first, under Wisconsin law, you don't get to the contract action involving subrogation until, under the tort action, the client is made whole. And you're saying at the fork of the road, you never get there. But doesn't the fork indicate that you have to go down the other side first?
I don't believe so. I believe that Wisconsin's, and I would say that Wisconsin does not have a highly developed conflicts of law question doctrine. It's something that's not been before this court very often. Judge Vandehey in the circuit court expressed surprise that the issue we're here arguing today had never apparently been litigated at an appellate level and didn't give him any guidance.
Is it fair to say that your contractual provision about the insured takes precedence over the insured takes precedence over the insured is an invalid void provision against the public policy of this state?
Well,
as applied to Wisconsin people. You could not have that provision in Wisconsin. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I agree that you could not have that in a Wisconsin plan, but this is not a Wisconsin plan.
I understand that. But the public policy of this state says in a Wisconsin plan, this is a void contractual provision. The question in this case is whether we apply that to a non-Wisconsin contract, to a Wisconsin resident.
And I think that question resolves itself into whether Wisconsin will afford effect to Iowa law in circumstances where it should be applied.
And you think that will, going back to Justice Crooks's question, should this court apply its law to this Iowa contract, you think it is a violation of full faith and credit or not?
Yes.
You think it's a violation?
Yes.
Why?
And again, the full faith and credit doctrine is not particularly well developed. The federal courts have not indicated a willingness to step into this, although it's my own opinion that as the population densities increase along borders, it probably will become a federal issue down the road, because each state has an incentive in a choice of law case to put its own thumb very heavily in the scale in favor of its own law, and it all devolves into forum shopping, and each state applies its own law. Even though it goes through a black box analysis of conflicts, it can't always come out that the forum applies its own law. Wisconsin's choice of law is based on the restatement second of conflicts of law and uses a balancing of interests or a grouping of contacts. And in this case, the significant grouping of contacts for purposes of the health plan and its coverage are all in Iowa.
Except in this case, there was a Wisconsin resident, a accident in Wisconsin, and I believe the other person was. So it's, you're looking at contacts, but what you're saying is that you should prevail because of the Iowa contract, and that's basically where it starts, at the law of Iowa. Yes.
Yes, because it's an Iowa contract, it's a health plan, and it's employment-related. For all the circumstances relied on in the Schlosser decision, Iowa law should apply.
Why do we not get to the
factors set forth in Heath and apply a Heath analysis as opposed to the grouping of contacts analysis set forth in the restatement?
I'm going to have to confess that I'm not, it's not ringing a bell, the Heath case. Is it a most significant?
It sets forth certain factors to apply in conflict of interest.
Did Mr. Drinkwater have insurance?
Health insurance?
Automobile insurance.
That I don't know. I defer to Mr. Hoskins on that. I think it is a temptation in every state to say, in every conflicts case, by definition, you have two states contending, you have two rules contending. It's very tempting to say in every case, because we have a rule, it's a matter of public policy. And that sort of reasoning will lead in every case to applying the law of the forum, and then it becomes a matter of who files first where. Let me propose a counterfactual example that I think shows why our holding is, or our argument is a good one. Let's say we have the reverse situation. A Dubuque resident commutes to Platteville, works at UW-Platteville, is covered by a Wisconsin health plan, and is involved in a car accident in Iowa with another Iowa driver. The Wisconsin health plan in that case should not be permitted to go into the Iowa court and say, we want subrogation under Iowa law. Even though the tort action is there, the accident's there, it's still fundamentally wrong from a contract standpoint to allow that insurer to go into Iowa and say, notwithstanding what our plan says, we would like to apply your law because it works better for us. The rule that we are contending for is a principled basis to resolve both of those cases. Certainly, there's no principled way argument for applying Iowa law in both cases or applying Wisconsin law in both cases.
Counsel, using your hypothetical, where would that action have to be filed? Would it have to be filed?
In all probability, it would have to be filed in, the tort action would have to be filed in Iowa.
In Iowa, right.
Yes.
Just as the tort action would have to be filed in Wisconsin under these facts, correct?
Yes.
But you would still, in your example, apply the make whole remedy to the Wisconsin resident because his policy was issued in the state of Wisconsin, even though he was injured in Iowa, which has no such remedy, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Because it's a matter of the contract between the insured and the insurer.
So you don't look at the tort action in your example, but rather at what rights does the injured person have under the policy that applies to his recovery?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Well, in the example you gave, what public policy would there be in Iowa to apply Iowa's no make whole? That's where I have trouble with your example, because there is a public policy in Wisconsin to consider that contract clause is invalid, at least as to Wisconsin contract. What would Iowa's public policy be to violate the contract in order to apply its law?
I would say it would not have an overriding public policy to do that and should enforce Wisconsin law.
Which is the same argument you're making the other day.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crump.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Hoskins, representing Shane Drinkwater.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it please the Court, my name is Mark Hoskins, and I represent Shane Drinkwater. Mr. Drinkwater is a young man, and he is here today with us with various members of his family. In the year 2002, in September, he was badly injured, and since Wisconsin law has long, for 75 years at least, discussed concept subrogation as an equitable concept, I'd like to discuss first please the equities of this case, because I think that's central.
Is it an equitable subrogation we're talking about here, or contractual subrogation?
It's contractual, but our case law, Your Honor, says that it doesn't matter. The case law makes it very clear that if we have conventional, which equals contractual, or if we have legal, which equals equitable, we treat these all the same. The trilogy of cases, Garrity, Rhimes, and Ruckel, all go to that same holding. There's no distinction between contractual and equitable subrogation in a tort matrix like this. Mr. Drinkwater was not made whole. He had no less than 5 surgeries. His treating doctor, Dr. Marsh, who has a curriculum vitae of over 30 pages and has trained in Europe and in the United States and practiced for years and years, has said that this is one of the worst tib-fib fractures that he's ever seen. That is because it went through the joint. It affected both the tibia and the fibula and a bone called the plafond, which is the ceiling, as it were, before the joint at the bottom of the leg and at the top of the foot.
Counselor, isn't it stipulated that he was not made whole? I didn't think that was even a dispute in this case.
It is not in dispute, but one of the hang-ups, if you will, that I have with this case is that the HMO in its brief and in its argument seems to just discount the fact that this young man has had these very serious injuries where he almost lost his leg, and yet the plan, in a matter of equity, in a case that involves equity, the plan says, we want the first dollar. We come first as a plan. And my reason for mentioning the made whole issues in his injuries is that he's not made whole, and equity for 75 years since the Hamill case in 1931, equity has been the guideline as to whether we apply subrogation or not.
Counsel, I don't think that's at issue here. I think opposing counsel concedes he wasn't made whole, and they also concede that if Wisconsin law applies, they lose. So I think, you know, what you're arguing to us, you're singing to the choir, because that's not disputed.
Okay.
In this
case. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you. I would respectfully submit to this court that I don't think this is a conflicts case. I understand there's two ways to look at this, certainly, but I don't think it is a conflicts case. I think it's a tort case. If you look at the appellant's appendix at page 159, the appellant has a paragraph 14 where they recite in their pleadings that they incorporate by reference, the HMO incorporates by reference, all allegations of plaintiff in his complaint that are essential to state a negligence cause of action for personal injuries. So in line with the question asked by Justice Butler, I think that that is accurate, that we have a tort case here. We do not have a contract case. I would like to point out also that the Madison newspaper's case in 200 with second distinguishes, as do the economic loss doctrine cases, distinguish that we have a dichotomy in Wisconsin between tort and between contract. We have maintained the separation of those two types of cases. This is clearly a tort case. It is not a contract case. Also, another reason I don't think it's a conflicts case is from the language of the Ruckel case itself. Ruckel is only 4 years old. It's a 2002 case. Ruckel says completely unambiguously that you cannot defeat the made whole doctrine by contract.
How about if you have an insurance policy that's subject to ERISA, Counselor? Can it be defeated then?
And Ruckel, as authored by Justice Prosser, distinguishes ERISA. Ruckel says we're not dealing with ERISA, we're dealing with non-ERISA, non-self-funded plans.
Right, and that's where we are in this, in that this plan is funded by insurance, but if you had the same plan that were funded by the employer, then it would be an ERISA plan, and you could defeat the tort recovery by contract, correct?
That is true, and that is because of federal preemption and because of the federal Deamer Clause. But RECL distinguishes between those types of plans and non-ERISA, non-self-funded plans. So the second reason that I think this is not even, that this doesn't even rise to a conflicts case is because of the wording of RECL. RECL says in a non-ERISA context that you cannot defeat the made whole doctrine by contract. It is very clear. It is, RECL was a Humana contract. It states in RECL that the language in the contract was not ambiguous, that the language in the contract was specific, and RECL says it doesn't matter what the contract says. You can't defeat the made whole doctrine in a contract by use of a contract.
That was a contract, of course, a Wisconsin contract. And the difference in your opposing counsel makes the argument, at least, that in a conflict of law or in the area where there is a contract from another state, that it would make sense, and you wouldn't have all these, you would eliminate some of the problems if you simply followed the contract and not followed where it took place. And that's his argument. So RECL, and I brought up RECL, but RECL was a little different because it was where they tried to defeat the made whole in a Wisconsin contract, where this is in Iowa, where there isn't any made whole, and the Supreme Court there, I know the law has rejected specifically that aspect.
This case, Your Honor, is RECL on all fours with a choice of law clause.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. But since RECL says you can't defeat the made whole doctrine via contract, I think that the argument that's being made is contrary to RECL, notwithstanding the choice of law clause.
Mr. Hoskins, how do you answer opposing counsel's argument that under the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution, we're required to give full faith and credit to the Iowa provision in the Iowa policy?
I don't think this is a full faith and credit case. If full faith and credit really applies, it means that Wisconsin is entitled to run Wisconsin's own court system without interference from private parties that have endorsed a private contract. A contract entered into via an Iowa HMO should not be telling Wisconsin how its court system and its tort system is to be run. So I don't think we have a full faith and credit. The state of Iowa and the state of Wisconsin are not parties to this. This is a matter between private litigants. One other thing, reason why I do not think this is even elevated to a choice of law case is because we aren't contesting the HMO's basic contractual rights as that term is usually applied. For example, they can have their own deductibles, and they do. They have their own coverages, and they do. They've identified in the plan their own practitioners that are preferred practitioners. They have that right under Iowa law. By the way, 131 of those practitioners are Wisconsin practitioners, and they have the right to make investments, which we would otherwise regulate in Wisconsin under Chapter 620, accounting under Chapter 623, marketing under Chapter 628, and so on. They can do all that with their Iowa plan via the state of Iowa. They can file all of their documentation that is necessary through the Iowa Secretary of State or whatever the proper office is. What we object to is having the Iowa plan via that prohibited clause that RECL says you can't have run the Wisconsin's court system.
Counselor, if Mr. Drinkwater had his unfortunate accident in Iowa, would we then be applying Iowa's tort law to this claim?
We not only would, but of course, yes. If it's in an Iowa court, the Iowa courts should determine the Iowa tort remedies.
Well, doesn't that then end up with two employees covered under the same plan receiving different benefits depending on where they happen to have a tort action?
Well, I guess you could counter that argument, which I appreciate. I understand the argument or the question, but do we want different treatments for Wisconsin residents who are injured in accidents? Should one Wisconsin resident be made whole because he has a Humana plan that has these same clauses in it, and another Wisconsin resident not be made whole simply because he is with Medical Associates HMO?
Well, if I understand your argument, though, Counselor, if Mr. Drinkwater had been a resident of Iowa and had been injured in exactly the same accident in the same place at the same time, you'd still be here arguing he was entitled to Wisconsin's make whole remedy, right?
Yes, I would.
Right.
Yes, I would. Because we're in an Iowa court, Wisconsin court,
right,
with a Wisconsin accident. In this case, however, we have a Wisconsin resident. He still lives in Wisconsin, and he did at the time. A Wisconsin tortfeasor who lived down near Cuba City in southwestern Wisconsin. A Wisconsin insurance company, American Family, headquartered just outside of Madison. And Wisconsin funds, of course, from that insurance carrier. And so if we're dealing with a contacts, how many contacts with Wisconsin and Iowa, Wisconsin has more contacts. We did not, in this case, go forum shopping to try to find the most favorable forum. He was injured here in Wisconsin.
I'm not sure whether Justice Rogan is going to ask this question. If all the facts are the same, except that Mr. Drinkwater were an Iowa resident,
right,
and the accident was in Wisconsin, what would be the result?
I misunderstood her question, if that was her question. If it's a Wisconsin tort and a Wisconsin tort action, as here, is brought in a Wisconsin court, Wisconsin law should apply.
Even if Mr. Drinkwater had been a resident of Iowa?
Yes, and we have this all the time. We have people on vacation from Nebraska or California who have accidents here in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin evidence applies, Wisconsin procedure applies, service of process, and everything that relates to a Wisconsin action.
Could I ask whether Mr. Drinkwater had any kind of motor vehicle insurance himself?
He had liability insurance on the vehicle that he was driving. It was a motorcycle. He had no other insurance. He had no Medicaid coverage. So his only collateral source, which is a doctrine we've not discussed yet during my time here, his only other collateral source was the HMO proceeds.
No underinsured motorist coverage?
No, Your Honor. No. I do also, in that context, disagree with Mr. Crumpy's number. I think despite his damages of being well over $400,000, as determined by the court below, he would receive, with Mr. Crumpy's analysis, only $160,000. One other, and that brings to mind another question. What would happen if Mr. Drinkwater were hurt worse? What happens if the HMO's medical expenses that they pay are $251,000 and the only policy involved is a $250,000 American Family policy, as here? Under Mr. Crumpy's argument, the HMO would take all of the money. Mr. Drinkwater would take not a single dollar. There would be no reserve for the injured person. And we know what the objectives of tort law are. They have been briefed by the parties, the CLL case, the Thomas case. And one of the primary objectives of our tort law always has been to compensate the injured person. That would not be done here. There's one other thing that question raises while I'm thinking about it. It is not at all unusual, as those members of the court will know that have served as circuit judges, it is not at all unusual that we have multiple health plans. If somebody spends 3 years with medical expenses, sometimes the employer changes plans. They go from plan A to plan B. Sometimes a spouse's plan will pay some of the expenses. Now, if this argument is adopted, what are we going to do if one of the plans says that we have to use Iowa law in our Wisconsin courts, and another plan says we have to use Georgia or Illinois or Nebraska or Minnesota law in our Wisconsin courts? And add to that, if you will, the fact that we nearly always, we usually, have a med pay clause, a med pay rider on a vehicle that might be garaged somewhere else, and the med pay will provide some additional source. Let's take State Farm, which is one of the largest insurers in the country out of Illinois. Can they insert an Illinois clause? And then we have three different competing clauses. That would create absolute havoc for our courts.
How do you protect an insurance company from writing a policy thinking it's going to get back subrogation? Get back via subrogation some of its med pay, and then all of a sudden Wisconsin rewrites that policy in effect. It has made all of its plans on the basis of the Iowa law. Now it's in distress. I mean, this is assuming that they do their premiums in this manner, and that's subject to great debate. But that's what they're going to say, and that they're going to increase premium rates or decrease benefits, right? Possibly. That's against maybe public policy to allow that. Yeah.
Since the beginning of time, since the Hamill case in 1931, the subrogee has always maintained, if you take away our subrogation rights, if you adopt a made whole rule, if you allow a collateral source rule, it will always affect our rates. That's made in every single one of these cases. And I think it is the Rimes case that indicates that there is precious little empirical evidence that rates are indeed affected at all. It's in the Rimes case on page 277. Quote, there appears to be very little evidence that possible recoveries in subrogation are considered in the determination of insurance premiums.
Well, you also have two insurance premiums here. You have auto rates in Iowa and Wisconsin, and you have subrogation rates. So the extent that the subrogated company gets segregated, it may raise the auto rates, may not. Of course, this case, which appears significant, may really not be very significant in the long run, because my understanding that the legislature is considering a provision that says you segregate.
I have heard all kinds of proposed legislative proposals, and one never knows, of course, where that will end up. We do have the medical malpractice subrogation rule, which is, of course, different than it is here. But we have adopted, I hate to keep referencing this old Hamill case, but if you look at the law from an historical perspective, since Hamill in 1931, subrogation has been a creature always of equity. And we have, since Garrity 30 years ago, employed the made whole rule. It runs from Hamill to Garrity in 77 with second, to Rimes in 106 with second, to Ruckel in 253 with second, all the way up to the most recent one I found, which is the Howell, H-O-U-L-E case, which adopts Ruckel. In 267 was second. It's a 2003 case. It's a clean, clear, straight line of employing equity regardless of the origin of the claim of subrogation, whether it's contractual, conventional, legal, equitable.
Applying to
One of the things the law looks for, and I guess I look for, is some kind of predictability in the development of law. And using as a touchstone ply equity seems to me a pretty uneven path to predictability, because my idea of what's equitable may be different than what is your idea of equitable. Tell me why your approach, your argument, advances predictability in the law over that of your opposing counsel.
We, of course, employ equity in all kinds of areas, including family law, and I guess we all know that equity in that context is not terrifically predictable because different judges can do different things. But in the tort arena, with subrogation, with Ruckel, we have a great deal of predictability. We know that if it's a Wisconsin accident and Wisconsin law applies, we know what the damages are. We have the ability to promote judicial economy by holding a Rimes hearing instead of a full-blown jury trial, and we know that if the injured person is not made whole, that there will be that subrogation will not apply. We also know that the instant the injured person is made whole, that subrogation from that point on will apply. We've also incorporated the doctrine of collateral source into that very matrix, because in this case, Mr. Drinkwater does have the collateral source of his health plan. And all these concepts, as we point out in the brief, do work in tandem. Unjust enrichment is prevented by subrogation once the injured person is made whole. We allow subrogation correspondingly once the injured person is made whole. We allow a collateral source until the injured person is made whole. And with the matrix we have, particularly since Rimes, it has become highly predictable. You will note that there are fairly few subrogation cases before this court since Rimes, and Rimes is 25 years old now.
Counselor, do you see Schlossler versus Alice Chambers as having any bearing on our decision in your case?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Why not? Because, first of all, subrogation was never discussed. That was not an injury case at all. Collateral source was not discussed. The interrelationship of those terms with unjust enrichment was not discussed. All Schlosser was a company-wide, as I understand the case, was a company-wide life insurance scheme, not scheme, but a life insurance plan for the employees. And it really has no bearing on this tort case, this accident case, in my opinion. There's certainly nothing wrong with uniformity of entitlement under an employer plan. There's nothing wrong with
that. Doesn't an employer have to give uniform benefits under an employee plan? That's required by law, federal and state.
That's not an area in which I practice, but I would have to assume the answer would be yes. And yet, the Wisconsin courts should give uniformity of result for injured people that are injured in Wisconsin and necessarily need to file a Wisconsin action. If I may, there was mention of the Heath case early on, and there is a later case to that, and that is the Justice Crooks will remember it as the Polite Liquidating Trust versus Grade case. It's in 270 with second at 356. And that discusses, again, I contend that this is not a choice of law case. But if this court, in its wisdom, determines it is a choice of law case, there are two applicable tests. And 18 pages into Beloit Grade, which brings us to page 374, those two tests are discussed. They are called choice of law principles. They supersede the older case, the Wilcox case, in 26 with second. They adopt the Heath case, which is in 35 with second. The first one is that you look at whether the adoption of the choice of the law choice, the other state's law, would involve officious intermeddling, which is a term I love.
So did Justice Chris.
And if it is officious intermeddling, then we stop there and we don't go any further. I maintain that if this is a choice of law case, to have Iowa decide what our equity will be, our unjust enrichment, our collateral source rules will be, would be officious intermeddling. However, if it's not officious intermeddling, then you go to the 5 test, which is called the second test, which was first mentioned in the Heath case. Number one is, as the question would indicate, the earlier question, is predictability of results. And I maintain this is highly predictable if we adopt Wisconsin's law. Second is maintenance of interstate order. And I maintain with the other example I gave you, with multiple HMOs and multiple plans and multiple plaintiffs who might have to draw, each of which may have multiple HMOs with choice of law clauses, I think maintenance of interstate order mandates a use of Wisconsin law. Simplification of judicial task is the third. And clearly we have a simplified judicial task because our law, no offense to the state of Iowa, but our law is more developed in this area. We have been through Rimes, Garrity, Rimes, and Ruckel, and since 1931 we've dealt with these concepts. The fourth one is the most important, advancement of the forum's governmental interests. On the next page of Beloit Liquidating, it states, we further noted that if it appears application of the forum law will advance the governmental interest of the forum state, this becomes a major, though not determining, factor in the choice of law. And the fifth is application of the better rule of law.
Do we get to that Heath test, that five-prong Heath test, if we can easily apply the restatement statement of conflicts test? In other words, does that supersede? I thought we applied the.
To answer your question, I think Beloit Liquidating is the law in Wisconsin. It's a 2004 case. It discussed this direct issue of conflicts of law. Also, in our brief, we point out that the conflicts of law cited by other counsel deals only with contract conflicts of law, and there's a citation in the preamble to that choice of law for torts is typically determined by the location of the tort and the forum of the court that deals with that tort.
Suppose you had a Wisconsin statute that says you always have to consider the collateral, you have to consider a collateral source, and you always deduct it, and there's always subrogation. And it doesn't provide for any allocation of fees and costs. It would seem to me that the Iowa law would be more favorable than the Wisconsin law. I'm trying to give that as an example. So,
if that were an example, I think that's correct. That would be more favorable.
Okay. And if you have the Iowa contract more favorable to the victim, then the Wisconsin public policy is now stated not by the court but by the legislature. What would your position be? What applies? The Wisconsin rule or the Iowa rule?
I honestly can't answer that, Your Honor, in the abstract without knowing what the actual statute stated.
Given it to you. It's very unfavorable to your client.
I suppose if the statute says the sky is red,
right,
then we have to go by what the statute says.
Even if Iowa is more favorable to you.
Even if Iowa is more favorable and even if I don't like it. But, again, that isn't the law yet.
Yeah, because you think that Wisconsin law applies, period.
I think Wisconsin law applies. I honestly do not think that it can be otherwise with this situation. And I go back to my earlier argument that if the plan can do this in a Wisconsin court, we really are going to have a chaotic situation because it's an invitation to have contracts of adhesion. Make those contracts as tough as you can. Make those contracts as this one is first dollar. The first dollar goes to the plan, not the person who's injured. Make those contracts so that the injured person, as here with this contract, has to sign over a power of attorney to his health plan to receive those funds, granting a lien, granting a reimbursement provision, so that we reward draconian plan provisions if we adopt this argument made by the HMO. We've never gone that route in Wisconsin since the beginning of time, and I really feel that such an argument for our court system would be misplaced. I think it's contrary to the Beloit liquidating analysis. I think it's contrary to any consideration of the made whole rule, and it's contrary to the collateral source rule. I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Crump, you have 5 minutes.
I did not get around to the second mural in my opening discussion, but that's the trial of Chief Oshkosh on the right. And in that case, which was the first jury trial in Wisconsin, a jury convicted Chief Oshkosh of murder when he avenged the death of a kinsman of his at the hands of members of another tribe. Judge Doty found the application of territorial law to Chief Oshkosh to be unjust because it was not the law that governed his people. Now, I don't know if I can call Iowans a people, but the same kinds of issues apply in this case and in every conflicts case. It's always easy to just say, whatever the analysis is, it's easier for us to apply our own law. That's going to be the case in every state, and that's where you wind up with chaos. If every state says my law is paramount, you'll wind up with chaos. So a ruling in that way doesn't remove it, it may solve the local chaos problem, but it contributes to the global chaos problem.
Mr. Crump, if I can follow up on that, I'm always concerned about the ramifications of our opinion and how far they may reach. If we accept your analysis as controlling, don't we set up the possibility that corporations, that insurance companies can shop around for the state that has the laws in their best interest, move into that state, issue all the contracts from that state, and thereby avoid the public policy of the various states when accidents occur within those states?
I think insurance policies have always been more regulated in that regard than other policies, and in this case, the regulation of the policy is in the state of Iowa. Insurance regulation is a state function. Iowa regulates those kinds of provisions. Let me say what this case is not. It's not like the California case that the Court of Appeals referred to in its certification. That was a case where a California securities company wanted to sell securities to a California resident without being inconvenienced by California's apparently rather draconian securities laws. So they both flew to the airport in Reno and signed the contract there with a choice of law provision that says Nevada law applies. That clearly is something that was done simply to circumvent the laws of the state that would certainly have applied otherwise.
But I'm not sure that really answers my question. Maybe I misstated it. And the reason, using medical associates, now that's based in Iowa, correct?
That's correct. And
the plan is from Iowa?
Yes.
And the employer is from Iowa?
Yes.
All right. What if medical associates had set up its headquarters in Louisiana?
I don't think, one, the regulators would permit that because it's regulated by the Iowa Department of Insurance. But secondly, we don't have that case. And in terms of the effect of precedent and the concern over the slippery slope, I think that is addressed by the scope of your ruling. The ruling that we are asking for is that when you have an Iowa health plan, an Iowa employer, an Iowa place of employment, and an express choice of Iowa law, when you have all of those factors present, Wisconsin will apply Iowa law. Now, that substantially limits the kind of scenario that you pose there. It's a matter of narrowing the ruling in anticipation that there will be further development of the case law on this down the road.
Could I ask you to respond to the hypothetical if the medical expenses had been $251,000? All go back to the health care company?
Under Iowa law, it would, yes. States can address that problem in different ways. Part of it is through their welfare systems, but part of it is people buying their own insurance. In Iowa, for example, requires car owners to have uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. It's not as if someone who wants to have adequate insurance in the event of an auto accident doesn't have the ability to get that. They do.
Are you familiar with a case, I think the name was Gillette. We had it a couple of years ago and involved an auto accident in Canada. Are you familiar with that case at all, counsel?
I am not, but it's certainly a situation that could apply here. We think the same law should apply whether the accident happens here or Hawaii.
My recollection is Wisconsin residents auto accident in Canada, and my recollection is that we had some language in that opinion that Wisconsin's policy of making victims of tort fully compensated was the controlling factor in that opinion. I mean, that was of great essence, our public policy.
Well, I guess the short response is the full faith and credit clause does not apply to Canada law. There is that canvas in the background of this case. I am out of time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Crump, and thank you, Mr. Hoskins, for your argument on this case involving both tort and contract law, although that's a subject of debate, too. That will conclude our hearing in 04-AP-1793, Shane T. Drinkwater v. American Family Mutual Insurance Company. The court will take a few moments in recess so that these students may leave and the Edgar High School students may enter the courtroom, and we will be back momentarily to hear our second case. We are in recess.